Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now our monthly Call Your Senator segment with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. New Yorkers, call your senator if you have a question about federal government policy that she's involved with or anything else relevant. 212-433-WNYC. Non-New Yorkers may call, too, across state lines. 212-433-9692 or tweet a question for Senator Gillibrand at Brian Lehrer. Some topics we may get to touch on include things the senator is interested in that might still be possible, even with a newly divided Congress this year. Maybe a paid family leave bill, plus what the senator calls an aging master plan, and a few other things. Also, the debt ceiling battle already underway, including over the defense budget. Senator Gillibrand is on the Armed Services Committee. She was recently on a bipartisan trip to Arab countries and Israel in the Middle East. And on the political side, Senator Gillibrand recently announced officially that she is running for re-election next year. Again, our phone number to call your senator, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Senator, always good of you to join us. Welcome back to WNYC for the first time in 2023.
Thank you, Brian.
If you're running for re-election, does that mean you're ruling out running for president again, even in the unlikely event that President Biden doesn't run for re-election?
I am definitely running for the Senate, and I support President Biden's reelection, so I do not have any presidential run on my mind right now.
All right. I guess if he decides not to run, then we'll have another conversation. And as you know, Democrats just lost several House seats in New York in November, largely over the issue of crime, even though crime is mostly a state and local government issue, not federal. And that gave Governor Hochul a closer call as well. And even Senator Schumer only won by 14 points against Republican Joe Pinion, who nobody ever heard of. Do you have a crime policy that can stand up to Republican attacks?
I do. I think public safety is vitally important. And I think people from around the state felt that public safety needed to be invested in and needed to be a priority. One of the bills that I just passed a few months ago will help to solve some of these stresses and concerns. We passed the first federal anti-gun trafficking bill, and the ATF literally just used that legislation to prosecute and took 50 weapons on the streets of Brooklyn, which is going to save lives. So the bill actually worked. The bill also had a lot of money in for violence disruptors, for mental health. And so I've been talking to our church leaders around the state, our not-for-profits around the state, to urge them to apply for this money so that we can stop shooters, so that we can prevent kids from joining gangs. And that money is now ready to be applied for. And so if we can get more money into these communities that we and created, this is an opportunity to really address safety at its root, keeping guns out of the hands of criminals and violent people, and keeping violent people and mentally ill people who should not have access to guns, getting them the treatment and programs they need so they don't become criminals.
All right. Your phone is breaking up a bit, Senator. Listeners, it's not your radios or other devices. So I don't know if you can try to stabilize it where you are. Otherwise, we could take a break and try to call you back. But let's try one more question before we do that and see how it goes. And as a candidate for re-election, you know, there's so much money in politics these days. Are there any industries that you won't take campaign donations from?
So I don't take any corporate PAC money, and I don't take any lobbyist money. So those are two things that I put in place several years ago to just emphasize that everyday people's voices should not be drowned out by the big dollars of large corporate interests. And one of my goals has been to actually get money out of politics, to actually have a publicly financed elections so that people can participate and not be drowned out by the wealthy, the uber wealthy or the uber well connected. And so that's one of my long-term ambitions. And it was one of the cornerstones of my presidential run was a pledge and an ambition to get money out of politics.
Let's take a phone call. Mary in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Hello. I'm calling today for an issue that's very close to my heart. It's Tree Smart Trade, and Dr. Gary Lovett from Carey Institute worked very hard on this, putting together these bills. They're in, and I know Senator Gillibrand is a supporter of this, but I just wanted to encourage her to look at the issues around Tree Smart Trade. It's preventing invasive species from coming in on pallets, and these pests are ruining our forests. And so this is an ecological issue that I would like brought up.
Mary, thank you very much. Are you familiar with that, Senator, the Tree Smart Trade Bill?
I'm not specifically knowledgeable about the bill she's referencing, but I know the issue very well, and I am on legislation to prevent invasive species from coming into our countries through pallets and also through boats. Sometimes the bilge water that's in a shipping boat, they will release that bilge water when they're in the Great Lakes, and it's often filled with invasive species. So we have two real challenges. And, you know, we have so many invasive species, especially in places like the Adirondacks and in our waterways. We have milfoil in our lakes. We have the ash borer beetle. We have so many very, very destructive species from other countries, often from Asia, and that when they get into the United States, they displace the natural species that would normally live there, and they can create massive pollution in our lakes. When you have milfoil, it clogs and creates algae and other horrible things. It harms the fish and fisheries. When you have these beetles and other type of insects, they destroy crops, they destroy forests, they destroy ecosystems. And so I take these issues very, very seriously. We may have opportunities in the Farm Bill this year to put in some kind of resources for research, development, and action plans. So I'm hopeful that we can attack this head on.
All right. Rob in Astoria, you're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Senator. Brian, thanks for taking my call. So I'd like to ask Senator Gillibrand her stance on potentially passing a law that would punish politicians for knowingly misleading or lying to voters. You know, I'm thinking about George Santos issues and election deniers. You know, we have laws that punish individuals in the private sector that knowingly mislead investors. I'm thinking about Elon Musk. So why can't we have a similar law targeting politicians?
So I share your concern about George Santos and how much he lied to the voters. And there are laws that apply to him. There are issues of fraud. There's issues of campaign finance violations. If he lied about where his money came from and it came from a foreign source, those are all violations of campaign finance laws. So there are laws that we can use in this instance to give law enforcement the tools they need to actually prosecute a case against him for various lies and various efforts of fraud. If he's convicted, that will affect him deeply. He doesn't have to step down from office unless he's actually convicted, I think. And in the interim, the Ethics Committee could do an investigation, but under this House of Representatives, I don't think they're going to do any investigations. So the real recourse for voters on Long Island is just to vote him out in the next election. It's only a year and a half away, so we have a very short time to organize around a candidate who's honest, who represents the values of that district, and try to unseat him. But the only way that he would be leaving office, I think, is if he is convicted. And I don't even know that you have to leave office if you're convicted, but I think it becomes such a headwind that members of Congress have resigned in that situation. So I think short of a conviction, he's the congressman for now. Whether, you know, you're talking
specifically about changing laws, I'd really have to look at it to figure out what part of the fraud laws aren't covering his actions, because normally in a political context, the solution is you vote them out.
Kind of a follow-up. Listener tweets, does the senator support replacing Jay Jacobs as head of the New York Democratic Party, given the recent disastrous election result? And I guess that could be taken to include the failure to vet George Santos enough to publicize this stuff in advance and defeat him and save that seat.
I don't know that you can say that the George Santos problem was because of Jay Jacobs. In fact, opposition research should be done by the candidates. It should be done by the DCCC. It should be done by a whole host of political apparatus up and down. And so those are mistakes, I think, that were made. Also, the press didn't cover it. To the extent they were aware that he was lying about stuff, they didn't cover it. So there's a lot of finger pointing to blame.
Mm-hmm. But also to the caller's question, the larger loss of seats in the House in New York State.
Yeah, so the larger loss of seats is something I care deeply about. And I'm actually going to try to raise resources into the state party to help fund a coordinated campaign, to actually work with the candidates to do mailers, to do robocalls, to do lawn signs, to do lit drops for door-to-door. Because if you do a coordinated campaign, you tend to have a stronger message. And I'm the only statewide candidate in 24, so if we want to win back this House majority, the way we do it is run a better campaign and really do the coordinated campaign and raise resources to fund more field, more door-to-door, more grassroots advocacy. And I'm really excited about that. So that's the kind of campaign I'm going to run for my reelection, and I'm hoping I can help the five candidates win back these five House seats. Because if we can deliver five out of New York, we only need to get four or five from somewhere else. Oh, only one? There's only six short? Okay. We only need one from somewhere else, which is pretty great. So we could really deliver if New York focuses on this election cycle very intensely, which I intend to do.
Sherry in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a Jewish New Yorker, and I am very concerned by the size of the military budget, which is ridiculously large when we have so many other needs, and in particular by the continued allocation of $3.8 billion to Israel when there is this ongoing extrajudicial murder of Palestinians, and this new government, which is more and more committed to destroying Palestinian villages, to chance of killing all Arabs. And what are we doing sending our money to this government that includes some Jewish extremists who actually call themselves fascists?
Sherry, thank you very much. Two issues there, really, the size of the U.S. defense budget and our policy toward Israel and the Palestinians. Just for a little more context for our listeners, I know you were in a bipartisan delegation to Israel and several Arab countries that are signatories to what's known as the Abraham Accords. And you were quoted on JewishInsider.com saying you've never been more optimistic about the region. So what makes you optimistic, and what do you say to Sherry's concerns?
Well, first of all, thank you, Sherry, for your concerns. And we have to do much more to help the Palestinian people. And what I'll talk about a little bit is what I learned in this trip that I just took to the Arab world and to Israel to talk about the Abraham Accords. You might not know much about that, but in the last year of the Trump administration, they were able to put together an international agreement between six countries, and we visited five of them. And it was Morocco.
And you're starting to break up a lot again. Is it positioning? Is it something you can stabilize again? Because you seem to be able to
do it before. I'm on a landline, so it's a little frustrating. Let me just see if it's a plug that's not plugged in well.
Suddenly it got better again just now. So
is that
I apologize.
Better? Is that better?
I think so. I want to try to just continue your answer.
If you can hear me. Okay, so we went to Morocco, Bahrain, UAE, and Israel. We didn't go to Sudan because it wasn't safe. But the purpose of the Abraham Accords is to say, to have Middle East peace, you need to engage the Arab world directly with Israel so that you can have a much more collaborative relationship as a mechanism for several things. One, economic growth in the region. Two, a regional security plan, missile defense systems. And three, to help the Palestinians. And what I saw on this trip is that Morocco, Bahrain, and UAE are very excited and very dedicated to these Abraham Accords. They want to have a deeper relationship with Israel. They want to have a broader relationship with Israel and the United States to build a much more regional economic security plan and national security plan. Morocco, for example, not only are they preserving Jewish cemeteries, they are now going to teach Jewish history, the Holocaust, and the Jewish cultural impact it's had on Morocco, because there's a lot of Jewish Moroccans. And so they are committed to it, to begin to create peace between Arabs and Jews. In UAE, they've just put together the Abraham, what is it called? It's like three religious sites. It's a church, it's a mosque, and it's a synagogue. And they're beautiful. They're almost to be opened. It's called the Abrahamic Family Center, and it is stunningly beautiful. And it's all about lifting up these three faiths so that people can begin to stop hating Jewish people for their
faith. Senator,
I'm
sorry to jump in on such a poignant note, but the line is continuing to deteriorate. So here's what we're going to do. I know my producer has your cell phone number, so we're going to call you back on that line.
Just call me out, and I'll do it on the cell. Okay, call myself.
So we're going to call you back on the cell. In the meantime, listeners, we'll take a break and we'll continue and pick up where we left off with Senator Gillibrand talking about the Middle East right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand for another few minutes. And I guess we've reached that point in history where a cell phone can have better audio quality than a landline. Took us a long time to get to this point in history, but I guess we're there. Senator, follow up on what you were just saying.
Yeah.
Jewish Insider. Did you want to finish a thought? Go ahead if you'd like to.
Yeah, I just wanted to finish the thought. So each of the countries was focused on what they can do to teach the people that Jews are not their enemies, which is so important. And if we could broaden this agreement and we could ask these Arab countries, we will enter into much more economic ties between the United States, Israel, and you. And we will invest in your defense, your joint defense, F-35s, missile defense systems. But in exchange, you have to help us rebuild the Palestinian Authority. You have to, for example, each one should take water infrastructure. Somebody could take sanitation. Somebody could take education infrastructure. Somebody could take a healthcare system. And they could invest billions of dollars every year to rebuild that country. We met with the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, and I specifically asked, if we convince the Arab world to make these real investments, would you be willing to partner with the UAE or Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or Morocco to rebuild your water infrastructure, to rebuild your roads and sewers, to rebuild your hospitals? And they said, absolutely. So this is a possibility of a regional Middle East peace plan that can help and support the Palestinians to create a path for peace and to have the ability to protect the region from Iran. And the real problem right now is Iran and its proxies are waging a war in the whole region. UAE was just bombed by the Houthis, which is a Iranian proxy. Morocco is worried about Hezbollah and Hamas. They're all worried about Iran and these proxies. So if you can create a regional defense system and try to de-escalate this drumbeat towards war that Iran has, that's a good thing. More people will be protected, more lives will be saved. And in exchange, what we should ask from the Arab world, which is extremely wealthy, is investment in the Palestinians. And I'm optimistic that that's possible. That's why my trip was so optimistic and why I feel hopeful.
To the caller's concern, are you soft-pedaling some of the things that the Israeli government is doing right now? For example, there's the Netanyahu government trying to weaken the Israeli Supreme Court to make it so that Parliament could overturn Supreme Court decisions. That would have implications for constitutional protections for Palestinian rights, critics say, as well as for Israel's democracy itself. Imagine if Congress in this country could just cancel Supreme Court rulings they don't like. So do you have a position on that issue?
Yeah, I do not support those decisions by the government. I think they are extremely problematic for many reasons. And I don't agree with the members of Prime Minister Netanyahu's government. But when we did meet with him, which is something we must do as our responsibility to focus on the Abraham Accords and regional peace, he said, despite these concerns that many New Yorkers have and many Americans have, that his views are the only relevant views when it comes to those issues. We are not going to agree with Prime Minister Netanyahu on these issues. And so my goal is to find solutions that I can work with the government to implement to help the Palestinian people. I can't control elections in Israel. I can't control positions of various politicians. But I believe there are civil society organizations within Israel and with the Arab world who very much want to have a path to peace and want to help the Palestinians. So, again, I'm optimistic because this is an opportunity that we've never had. The Arab world does not invest in Palestine, does not invest in the Palestinian Authority, does not invest in the Palestinian people. And so we, using our leverage of this request to invest economically and in national regional security, this can be our request. And that could result in billions of dollars flowing to help Palestinians get clean water, to have electricity that is reliable, to have better roads and sewer systems, to have a sanitation, a plan, to have hospitals and schools that work. That should be the result of the Abraham Accords.
And to the caller's other question, just about the U.S. defense budget and its size, as you know, one of the things that some Republicans want to cut in order to agree to raise the debt ceiling is the $80 billion or so that Congress added to the defense budget last year over what President Biden requested. And there seems to be a strange bedfellows left-right coalition forming on this. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who some people think might primary you, tweeted to put this $857 billion number into perspective, it would cost $90 billion a year to cut child poverty in half. So what do you say to the Republicans on the right, to members of your party on the left, who think the defense budget was too big, and I think you supported that number that got passed?
Yes, and I feel very confident that it is essential that we invest in our national security. I sit on the Intelligence Committee, and I sit on the Armed Services Committee. And we, because of our investments, have subverted over two dozen terrorist attacks since 9/11. And part of that is supporting allies around the world. Part of that is making sure we can win a war on more than two fronts at any given time. We have Iran, who wants to, unfortunately, start a nuclear war. They are moving towards nuclear capability through missile technology right now that is shockingly concerning. We have China, who has an ambition to defeat America in a world war over Taiwan, and we don't know when that will happen, but could be, certainly within this decade. And we have terrorism that continues to grow. So we can't, we cannot stop investing in our national security, because when we do, it means we can't stand up to Putin when they invade Ukraine. We have sent the Ukrainians so many different types of military technology, different guns, different ammunition, different missile launchers, different types of defensive weaponry to protect millions of lives. And we could not do that if we had not been investing every year since. NATO chose not to invest. They chose not to spend 2% a year of their GDP on defense. And they were largely defenseless when Russia decided to invade Ukraine. They have enormous national security risks because they're not prepared. They assumed we are in a post-World War era. They didn't believe that any state would be so belligerent as to invade another state without cause. Well, we're living it right now, and I can promise you that whatever Putin does and whatever America does in response, China is watching very intensely about how much will America defend other places. Can we invade Taiwan, a democracy, anytime we want, and no one will do a thing? That's not something I'm willing to agree to, and so we do need to invest in our defense. It doesn't mean we also don't need to invest in child poverty. And I've always been of the view, whatever we spend on defense, we should be spending on domestic priorities as well. The Republican Party disagrees. They do not want to spend any amount of money on a lot of these priorities. They want to cut the budget. They want to continue to give tax cuts to the most wealthy so that they don't have to invest in schools and hospitals and roads and bridges and healthcare and food security and all the things that keep our communities safe. And unfortunately, we don't have the House majority right now. We have lost the House majority, and we need to win that back because with that majority, we can invest in the many ways we have. I mean, when we created the child tax credit and we tried to make it permanent, it cut child poverty in half. It worked. It actually worked. The money we put into the COVID recovery bills to invest in our hospitals, to invest in our small businesses, to invest in our first responders, that money worked. It kept our economy surviving during the last 3 years. So we need a Democratic majority to really do these things, but I don't think the answer is cutting the defense budget. You can definitely criticize where in the defense budget different dollars are spent, and that's something we do in the committee all the time, but I would not. It's such a simplistic solution, and it's so ill-informed, and you don't have access to the same information that I do on these two committees about our defense and our intelligence for national security. We need those resources. Those resources have helped the Ukrainian people immeasurably. And those are the resources that we're investing in satellite technology, in AI, in supercomputing, in semiconductors. All of that will go towards protecting America from an attack by China someday.
Let me do my legal ID here, and then I'm going to ask one quick follow-up question, and then we're out of time. This is WNYC, FM, HD, and AM New York, WNJT, FM, 88.1 Trenton, WNJP, 88.5 Sussex, WNJY, 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO, 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio and live streaming at WNYC.org. Senator Gillibrand, just in our last 30 seconds or so, on those domestic issues that you have championed, I know we've talked before about your interest in a paid family leave bill for the U.S., one of very few Western countries that doesn't have one, and that polls very well. Is there a possibility of a standalone bill? I know it got cut out of Biden's larger Build Back Better bill. Is this something you think is potentially a wedge issue that Democrats could pursue in the current Congress, or you think not so much?
Well, it doesn't have to be a wedge issue. It could actually be a bipartisan issue. And I have a working group with Republicans right now, led by Bill Cassidy. I reached out to Republicans on the House side, Elise Stefanik. And we are going to work as hard as we possibly can over the next few months to see if there is any common ground. And, you know, the Republicans are much more in favor of lots of tax cuts to make it easier for businesses to offer paid leave. But they don't support my vision for paid leave, which is a universal system where everyone invests in it like Social Security so that the money is there for them when they need it, matched by employers. That's the ideal paid leave plan for all life events for up to 3 months. But there are some ideas about maybe covering paid leave for the lowest income workers, and that maybe that will be acceptable to the Republicans. The good news is we all seem to agree it should be 12 weeks for all life events, all people.
One way or another. Did you say Elise Stefanik is interested in working with you on this?
Yeah, she, apparently she's open to it now that she's a mom. She begins to see why these things really affect working people. But paid leave is overwhelmingly bipartisan for the American people. And politicians are the ones who have been lagging. So if we can inspire a few more people to care about this because their constituents care about it, maybe we could get a bipartisan bill together. So I'm just going to keep fighting for it as long and hard as I can. I will work on it even when the Republicans control the House. And if I can put together at least a good first step towards paid leave, I will. So that's my ambition right now, to try to get that done.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, we always appreciate when you come on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian.